Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Symmetry of Soul, an ongoing endeavor to grasp the Urantia book in a synthetic wholeness. Tonight, paper 139, section 6. It's our arc, Jesus Goes Public. Something else from 20th century philosopher slash businessman Peter Drucker. He wrote, "One hears a great deal today about the end of hierarchy. This is blatant nonsense. In any organization, there has to be a final authority, someone who can make the final decisions and who can expect them to be obeyed." I'm Brad Garner. I'm so glad that you're here live or in our archive at symmetryofsoul.org. It's Tuesday evening, and with us tonight is the usual crew, Dr. Chris Halverson, our teacher, Andrea Barnes, Herman Anderson, and you. Please call up the text of the Urantia papers however you please on your computer or in your lap or on your laptop and settle in for about 1% of your week. Focus in with us as we study this epical revelation to our world. Good evening, Dr. Chris.
Good evening, Brad. Yeah, I couldn't help but think of the Ancients of Days there, a final authority whose mandates he expects to be obeyed, or they expect to be obeyed. That's why they're the capital J judges, after all. But, yeah, great to have you bring in little tidbits like that for reflection. And hello to you, Andrea, and Kermit, and everyone who's joining us as we jump back into our precise, detailed analysis of the 12 apostles. We have one of the first six that we have to deal with, and then we'll get into the second set of apostles that the first six picked. Everyone knows we're in paper 139, the 12 apostles, and I think we're all enjoying seeing what new tidbits we can mine from the revelation.
We are certainly enjoying that. This is one of those papers that is pretty accessible on the face of it, but can be a little dry on the face of it if you're not into just reading character sketches or temperament sketches, to be more precise. But as you dig into the depths of it, you can see the intricacies of not only how this organization of apostles and Jesus was set up to succeed, but also, I'm thinking, just perhaps a glimmer of somehow that inscrutable acts of wills of supremacy. Like, all these people needed to be exactly where they were, exactly when they were. Isn't that interesting? And Andrea, good evening to you. How's everything out your way?
Everything out here is hot. It's summertime, so longest day of the year. I'm sure glad to be here. I'm very much enjoying these papers as well, this arc. So, yeah, looking forward to tonight's study.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much, Andrea, and thanks for the reminder. It is the longest day of the year. Please enjoy your various old wineskin pagan festivals safely. Thank you all. And Kermit Anderson, good evening to you. How is everything going for you, and what have you got for us lined up review-wise?
Well, good evening, Brad, and Chris, and Andrea, and everyone in the chat room, and on the switchboard, and enjoy the longest day of the year. Enjoy the light today. Last week, we discussed preeminence of the individual. It's one of the divine ideals previously mentioned on Symmetry of Soul. It was an integral feature of the kingdom of heaven as Jesus taught it. Greek philosophy failed to recognize the individual as sacrosanct in favor of the family, and it was Christianity which exalted it to its recognition as divine ideal. Here is an example of an evolutionary phenomenon stimulated by revelation. The fifth epical revelation in the Planetary Mortal Epics paper lays out the revelatory plan whereby the divine ideals of representative government, national life, family life, and preeminence of the individual are revealed. Due to the rebellion and default, these ideals were not adequately established. Thus, we have the fifth epical revelation attempting to restore these ideals for the sake of securing progressive civilization as an ongoing phenomenon. The revelation reveals ideals and discloses facts and ideas, and it is the proper apprehension of ideals which must precede the entertainment and implementation of facts and ideas in their application if real progress is to be achieved. Continuing our narrative with John Zebedee, we are introduced to his unlovely trait of character, conceit, it being a mere hop, skip, and a jump to self-love. John's association with Jesus served greatly to ameliorate his conceit, but with increasing age it reappeared somewhat, as is evidenced by in the gospel bearing his name, wherein he repeatedly makes self-reference as the disciple whom Jesus loved. Dependable, prompt, and courageous describe the more laudatory features of his character. He most appreciated Jesus' love and unselfishness to the extent that his whole life became dominated by the sentiment of love and brotherly devotion, and he became known as the Apostle of Love. However, it is our author's choice of descriptors of John's love with respect to the levels of meaning that gave us pause. Genuine, real, sixth level of meaning love is a full two levels higher than brotherly love. Reflecting on Jesus' new commandment that we love one another as he loves us suggests that John failed to grasp the as he loves us qualifier. Such a love as he loves us knows no exception and gives no place for hatred. Failure to recognize and appreciate this distinction has led to a condition whereby the love we may have for our brothers and sisters is self-righteously withheld from those we may label enemy or stranger. He was reticent of speech, but gifted with a remarkable and creative imagination. He did, however, become more verbally expressive when his anger was aroused. Along with James, his brother, he did share a bigotry and intolerance somewhat uncharacteristic of one so quiet and introspective. John's character was markedly and permanently changed by his association with Jesus. This was due in particular to John's inside look at the master's itinerant lifestyle, while at the same time faithfully making provision for his family's needs in the face of their lack of understanding of their father-brother's mission. Plus, Jesus' daily life of implicit trust in the Father's watch care. His cool and daring courage was exhibited in his attendance at Jesus' side through the entire appalling arrest, trial, and death on the cross. John was early associated with Peter in the establishment of the Christian church, imprisoned several times, including his banishment to Patmos, where he penned the book of Revelation, which survives today in fragmentary and adulterated form. With increasing age, he grew more tactful and sagacious, thus avoiding the violent death of his brother James. The outstanding theologian of the 12 and one of the few apostles to die of natural causes, he lived to the astounding age of 101 years. Section 5, Philip the Curious. Nicknamed the Curious by his fellow apostles for his incessant inquiries, many of a foolish nature, he is described as lacking imagination, but methodical and thorough, mathematical and systematic, all of which served him in his assigned duties of steward of the apostolic core. He admired Jesus' unfailing generosity. He was a commonplace average man who appealed to many similar individuals in the multitudes who took comfort to see one such as themselves in an honored and elevated position in the councils of the Master. Illuminating to us is the disclosure that Jesus was really more interested in Philip's foolish questions than in the sermon which Philip might chance to be interrupting. Such was the Master's supreme interest in men of all kinds. Philip was not a good public speaker, but he was persuasive and successful as a personal worker with the great and rare gift of saying, "Come and see, I will show you the way." His lack of dogmatic persuasion enabled him to be the first of the apostles successfully to carry the message of the gospel outside the Jewish ranks to the Samaritans. Philip was accompanied by his wife in his evangelistic efforts, and we are graced in the revelation with a touching narration of the scene of Philip's crucifixion, with her stepping up to begin the recital of salvation through faith in Jesus when his strength failed, only to be silenced by stones at the hands of irate Jews. And here ends my review.
All right. Thank you so much, Kermit. Very well put together. And excellent selection of vocabulary, too. Thank you, as always, for taking the time. And thank you for a lifetime of investing in building your vocabulary. It helps us all. So I had a couple of thoughts that I wanted to lead off with. I think I'll just confine it to this one. See if I can find the words for it. It's occurring to me sort of spontaneously. So apologies for the usual stutters, but yeah, apologies as always. So over the weekend, my pet, my 16-year-old cat, died. He's been a companion with me through adventure and hardship, and it was, you know, it was difficult, but I've also lived long enough, and I've tried to approach this in a more mature philosophic manner than I did when I was 16, and the family cat died, and all I could do was be dogmatic from the Urantia book and say, well, he's not going to heaven. There's no heaven for cats, and so some form of, like, nihilism. That was unfortunate. So I've evolved in my thinking. You know, animals are here for a reason, but that's not actually my point. My point here is I was thinking, I had this Philip the Curious on my mind, this apostle who needed to be shown things, and they used the word prosaic to describe him. And what I found as I was sitting here in the day after, you know, processing the grief that needed to be there, there were a great many emotions welling up in me that were of a deeper nature as I mature in life. Things about loyalty and persevering and duty and, you know, interesting, higher, more beautiful attributes that you can ascribe to the human pet association. But there was this distressing one where I kept having this dissonance in my mind. Where's the cat? He's not here. Where's the cat? He's not here. There was this part of my mind that couldn't process the fact that it would expect to still find this animal in this household where it's been for 15 years. And in a moment of just whatever, I decided maybe it's some more prosaic aspect of my mind, some more lower part of my nature that just needs to be shown. And so over the course of the next day, I walked around my house and showed myself. It's a silly little trick, but it worked. I showed myself, he's not here, he's not here, he's not here. I went to all the usual hangouts. A couple of times, there was a part of me that honestly thought he would be there. And I feel that after the fourth time of showing myself this, it began to sort of rewire something that felt very mechanical, very prosaic, very salt of the earth. I'm not mad at it. I don't disdain that it's there, but I do think it is there, and I think that by acknowledging it, just saying it needs to be shown. It can't use imagination to extrapolate that this cat's not here. It needs to be shown. I think I may have sped that particular part of the grieving process up by a couple of days or something. So it's just interesting to apply something from paper 139 in the grieving process of a pet. So there it is.
Yeah, no, that's and just to take that point of recognition and then expand it outward into its generalized validity. And if nothing else, recognizing how many people on the planet function almost totally in that very literal, tangible only mode. As you said, they can't imaginatively extrapolate to any significant degree. We've talked many times about religionists throughout history and all over the world today, that still require a theology or doctrines that are very straightforward, literal, the bread and the wine can't be symbols. They need to be literally transubstantiated.
Right.
Scholarly sorts, dream up all the technical terms and whatnot, but the point is that bottom line, some people need that to be literal. Otherwise, it just is completely intangible, incomprehensible. And, and you know, it's very important to, you know, to as we're studying the fifth epical revelation, which is a challenge, you know, a direct challenge to those on the planet that are the most able to transcend the prosaic, the merely prosaic. Yeah, but most of the planet are, you know, can at best rise to the second philosophic level.
Yeah.
They're very prosaic, and, you know, if not, you know, like I'm stressing, you know, it needs to be, you know, they have to see it, they have to touch it, they have to taste it. You know, that basic instinct that a little child manifests when they stick something in their mouth. You know, a lot of people really live their whole life in just a sort of a fancified mode of, you know, let me stick it in my mouth. And so, you know, we can't have any delusions about how the fifth epical revelation is something that's meant to be, to resonate with most of mankind. It's just way too remote.
Right.
And so, you know, it all just strikes, you know the common person as, you know, some sort of metaphysical, you know, musings or something. Right? I mean, even this paper, right, even to reflect upon the temperament and contrast it with the character, et cetera, of each of the apostles, I mean, for an awful lot of people, that's just a whatever. Right? They just want to know, you know, who's a saint and, you know, and what's their, you know, what day do I remember them?
What's their theory?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Right. You know, so, yeah, it's always important to, you know, to keep that in mind. And then in terms of yourself, yeah, I mean, in this life, perforce, you serve two masters. And one of those masters, right, has no wisdom, no insight, no foresight, no imagination. I mean, it's just totally straightforward, literal, right? It's just slightly more advanced than if I close my eyes, the universe disappears, and that's why peekaboo is fun.
That's accurate. Yeah, I can vouch for that from last weekend.
Right. It's just that, you know, we that's always there, you know, until we get to the first mansion world, right? We live, you know, in part, you know, in that mode. You know, if I could just see God, well, then I would believe in Him. You know, and think about how difficult it is for creatures that are basically mentally like that to be an Agendonter. To achieve the heights of grasp, you know, of, you know, taking a hold of that which is, you know, is completely intangible and invisible.
Yeah.
Yeah. Blessed are those.
And yet here
who,
we are,
you know,
with the fifth,
believe and yet have not seen.
Yeah, and yet here we are. They gave the revelation to us in its current form, with hope, more than just hope. I assume that there would be some resonance.
It's genuine traction. Hope. Yeah. But kind of, you know, like you're saying, they definitely didn't give it to it just based upon even genuine hope, let alone, you know, wishful thinking.
Yeah.
But again, they didn't give it thinking delusionally. They were giving us a dispensational, universalizable revelation.
Yeah.
Right? Any more than the things that Machaventa said 4,000 years ago, you know, were really graspable beyond the Kenites. Right? The real heavy-duty stuff. You know, yeah. Otherwise, you know, outside of the Kenites that could grasp, you know, sort of genuinely revelatory material, you know, all Melchizedek did was just re-stimulate, you know, the fading embers of the second epical revelation.
Hmm.
You know, get the Sethite ministry sort of, you know, blow on those embers a little bit and, you know, and make sure there was something still, you know, at least smoldering by the time Michael incarnated.
Yeah.
Well, that's a great, that's a fun analogy to think about right there.
Yeah. And not to get off into religious speculation, but one wonders, well, if this is an emergency non-dispensational revelation as well, how much of that pattern is being repeated here? How much of it is meant to just fan some flames on smoldering embers, just keep enough alive for whatever the next big epical thing is that's coming?
Yeah, you know, I've been stressing a lot lately. You know, one of those fading embers is any sort of genuine identification with the concept of righteousness.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if we could just get some religionists on the planet again, instead of, you know, with each passing year, there are fewer religionists and more secularists. Right? And it's not because there aren't people that have all kinds of sort of ideas that go beyond the prosaic. And that's not why there's fewer religionists. You know, there's all sorts of, you know, speculative, mystical-minded, whatnot sort of, you know, dreamer people. You know, we call them quote-unquote spiritual. I bet they're not religious. You know, that's, you know, that ember of religion, you know, I mean, if that goes out, you know, then the lights go out. So, yes, there's, you know, there's very advanced revelatory material in the fifth epical revelation, right? For those select few that are, you know, that are, that still, you know, have religion burning at the core of their being. But, you know, the emergency part is, you know, is not, boy, we've got to somehow get them to understand the detailed physics of total deity. You know, the emergency is, you know, the lights are about
basic.
To go out.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, I've over the years, I've talked a lot about some of the very delightful, detailed, advanced, revelatory material in here, the things that allows you to clear up and move forward on and get. But that's not the entire story any more than that was the entire story with the last emergency revelation with Machaventa.
Right.
Right. There's two sides. You know, what is the emergency? What is fading?
Civilization.
Yeah, and the pilot light that powers that, you know, religious individuals. You know, you're not going to maintain civilization with a bunch of humanistic secularists.
That's what paper 195 goes to extensive pains to stress. I'm trying to get the last word in.
Yeah, it doesn't matter how much, you know, countless millions of people believe that that's, you know, going to, that all those humanistic secularists are going to produce, you know, incredible progress. So, no, they're not. And in the book, and like you're pointing out, 195 is very direct about it. It's like, no, progress would not be the word.
Mm-mm.
Now, it would be the most extreme opposite you can think of.
It would be like a solar system without a sun at the center. It would fly apart.
Yeah. Right, I mean, we want to, as we try to advance the recognition of the fifth epical revelation, we want to make sure that, you know, we keep an eye on both of these issues. you know, and not have any delusions that somehow we can make great progress in really advancing the directly revelatory parts of it, you know, to secular humanistic individuals. It's not going to happen.
Well, it is something to keep in mind. I'm reminded of something else in paper 195, as I often am, where they say that there's this tendency in humans to try to crystallize, dogmatize, pin down something that really tries to transform you with religious conviction. And it is as intellectual as we can be here on Symmetry of Soul. I hope it comes across that our fundamental message here is philosophic, it's religious, it's about righteousness. There are a great many very well-intentioned people in the so-called Urantia movement who pursue extreme forms of intellectual pursuit. There's a place for it, the physics and the cosmology and the astronomy and the geology. But if they do that to the exclusion of their personal religious experience, where does that actually leave it as an effective revelatory text?
And Chris, I have to remind you that I am a poster child for the converted secular humanist through the revelation.
Yeah.
It was the revelation that found me and redeemed me.
Me too.
Yeah. I cooperated.
Me too.
Yeah. Yeah, great point to bring up, you know, to clarify what I mean by that, you know, what I meant by that statement, you know, what you discovered, and, you know, you've kind of testified about this, I mean, you put on the garments, you know, of the agnostic or the atheist, you know, and tried to find fulfillment, you know, and a fervor therein, but it didn't work, right? I mean, you weren't really a secularist. And so that distinction, right? I mean, you know, Jesus, you know, there's lots of passages where Jesus is going along and he can discriminate between someone that, you know, the non-discriminating person would, you know, lump with the, with a sort of the lost. It's like, no, that person's not lost. They're just temporarily confused. And we can do something about that. Now, a revelation like Jesus of Nazareth can do something about that, right? They can show that person that they don't need to pretend to be something they really aren't in order to apparently give their life meaning.
Yeah.
He could show them, you know, you really are a religionist at heart, and let's reconsecrate ourselves thus. You know, and so. Yeah, but what I was speaking to is, you know, individuals that, you know, they're not putting on, you know, the garments of today just to, you know, get along and, you know, be part of a group. They really are individually dark inside. And those are the people where if you just say the word God, they roll their eyes, you know, and and it's not just, you know, them parroting what they've seen someone else do. You know, think, well, this is, you know, if I'm going to be a fancy person, an intellectual, I've got to roll my eyes right now, you know, and it's like, no, they really are that inside. Right? They've spiritualized. You know, it gets us back to paper 139 here. You know, what is a certain, you know, what temperament do you have, you know, just because you've taught that lower domain that way? You can teach that lower domain to be agnostic or atheistic. But what are you really? Right? Have you spiritualized any of that? Right? So that, you know, your will is behind it? you know, or is just your material mind inertia behind it? You know, will it resist revelation? I was speaking to those that are going to resist, right? You know, the difference in the audience that Jesus had. Some were like the, you know, the Sadducees and the Pharisees of the Sanhedrin. Others weren't.
Yeah.
You know, but when he met them, they both kind of seemed to be in the same space, right? But one was, you know, could still be affected by revelation, and the others only hardened their heart more when exposed to revelation. So, you know, that's what I'm getting at. And it's, things have changed since you were young, Kermit. I'm familiar with many people, right, of your age that, that weren't really as secular as they might have appeared to have been, you know, back in the 60s and 70s. But more and more, you know, we have young people that aren't just kind of off on a self-exploration tangent. There's nothing they can come back to when they get through that adolescent transition stage.
Yeah.
Their parents didn't put anything in them to begin with. And that's why there's an emergency, right? It goes beyond that generational transitional difficulty thing that even the ancient Greeks bemoaned, as we've talked about before.
And so not
to be pessimistic, you know, we'll read about being pessimistic here maybe tonight with one of these apostles, but when I say these things, I'm not putting forward pessimism. I haven't turned that into my complete lifestyle solution to be pessimistic. But you know, it's important to know that the way things were several decades ago is not the way things are now. Right? It's once you get four generations into this current descent, your young people, you know, are just, it's going to be very difficult to get them to be a religionist now. They are so, you know, there's just no ember that you can really blow on.
Yeah.
They're a very rabid humanist.
Very much, yep. Yeah.
You know, and
So
it's a very sad state of affairs. You know, if only it was just like it was, you know, 50 years ago. But it's not. And just to get back to the point at hand. I mean, when we're thinking about the revelation, you know, we need to keep that in mind. You know, there are ministries that could reach out to those that aren't totally lost, but it's not going to be the Urantia book. Right? It needs to be much more like Jesus of Nazareth, right? As he passed by, and he could bring the radiant light of a real faith into a dark corner of someone's life. Jesus walked around the Mediterranean with his inner light, not with the Urantia book.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But then there's some small subset of people on the planet, you know, which are going to be very difficult to find, that actually need the Urantia book, right, and paper 105.
Small. But that's not fundamentally new, not to get on a huge tangent. I mean, how many people have read Thomas Aquinas's Summa Theologica, but yet it has echoed through the ages and influenced, you know, highest thought? Most everyone else needs their mythologies and their simple rituals, and yet Summa Theologica is still out there reigning in ways. So,
You're just think in terms of the sequence of planetary moral epochs. There's an awful lot of people right now that are missing, you know, the foundational stuff of law and order. That's gotten lost in many people's hearts. That needs to be reestablished. Yeah, if you can get law and order established in their hearts, then the next phase is to bring in trust and faith. If you can get trust and faith established upon that law and order foundation, then we can bring in love and service. Right? And maybe we could even get to, you know, the 14 fundamental facets of total deity.
slow down there, cowboy. But
yeah. That might be a bridge too far, Chris.
I know, right? But just see, notice, I ended up with a very advanced law and order. Right? See, it comes back around, right? And you take that structure, that definitive, immutable structure that you established in that primitive human with law and order. Right, and the essence of that finally comes back around to getting into the physics of the cosmos,
mm-hmm.
and of deity. What are the laws, and what is the order that governs the functioning of facets of deity?
Right. It's a larger true concept frame.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway,
like you said, for most people, it's almost as if the world needs to see Jesus living again on earth in the experience of spirit-born mortals who effectively reveal the Master to all men.
Hmm. Almost as if. And since we can't get Jesus back here again, right, incarnate in the flesh, the only way to remedy that problem is what passage, you know, directly says, you have to have the faith of Jesus in your heart, right, so that you can walk up to anyone and it's as if Jesus is standing before them. Your faith is just as definitive and real as his was. Right, that is how the book ends. It comes down off of that mountain peak of, you know, papers 105 and 106, and ends with, okay, most people on the planet, what they really need, right, is that faith living again in other real humans, like
mm-hmm.
Jesus the man. Since that paper, that final paper was given to us, like I was just reminding us, yeah, unfortunately, you know, there's some of the people that could have been reached with the faith of Jesus have now slipped down. And, I mean, they're getting to the point where it's like, no, we need to go back to square one, 500,000 years ago, the prince's staff just, you know, appeared in awesome form in front of everyone, you know, and... you know, and they're all going, you know, everyone is saying, you know, you are our masters, you know, we hear and obey. I mean, it just becomes this, you know, awesome presentation of moral law. You know, and not even remotely getting to the love of God at that point. It's like, well, we've got to work on the basics first. Yeah. So, you know, that's one of the things that's becoming sadder and sadder about, you know, the fifth epical revelation and how it ends, you know, with that soaring paper on the faith of Jesus. Like, ah, man, but there's so many people now that it's like, no, that's not going to work anymore. They've just, you know, they're down at a primitive level now. You know, think about how many people weren't affected by the faith of Jesus just 2,000 years ago when
sure.
it was actually incarnate.
Yeah.
You know, they listened to him, you know, and watched him and, you know, and at best, you know, just shrugged their shoulders and, you know, went back to their lives, you know. and others killed him for it. Yeah. So, how much success is someone trying to embody the faith of Jesus just as definitively going to have today? Right?
You still ought to do that if you have the capacity for it, but don't expect.
don't pessimist. Yeah, don't be pessimistic, right? I mean, but also, don't be, take off the rose-colored glasses. You want to face facts and adjust them to ideals. Go forth with your eyes open, right? And figure out where there is, where you should throw those seeds. Don't throw it on the on the slabs of rock. I think there might even have been a parable about that. even back 2,000 years ago, he tried to remind us of this basic thing. It's like, you can't just be indiscriminate. And to kind of bring it back around to, I wanted to make one comment on the new commandment thing there. We were talking about how that prior concept, that's basically there with the great commandment prior to the new commandment, where love is brotherly love. In other words, love is kindness, and you're challenging yourself to try to expand your concept of who's your brother, or who's your neighbor. Think about that kindness and how, the book points out directly that indiscriminate kindness has led to all kinds of problems. Right? I mean, that bumper sticker of random acts of kindness is absolutely false.
Yeah, figured that out a while ago.
It's hard to explain to someone, though, to explain that. It's very difficult.
Right, they think they're going about doing good. It's like, no, you're going about doing evil. What?
Yeah, that goes over. Not at
right,
all.
That just is completely incomprehensible, right? Not to go off on that tangent completely, but my point is, as you were bringing up the divine ideals in your review, Kermit, and there are those four experiential divine ideals that you listed: preeminence of the individual, family life, national life, representative government. But that's fifth epical revelation sort of a level of bringing things forward in restoring our world. First step is what Jesus did 2,000 years ago. So now let's start with the existential divine ideal of love. Let's lift the word symbol up from, certainly above it, love being a feeling, but let's even lift it up, let's go up two levels from love being a feeling to kindness, to brotherly love. And he says, no, that's not enough yet. I want love to not be merely kindness. I certainly don't want it to be merely a feeling or anything else like that. I want it to be full-on a divine ideal. I want the word symbol love to indicate a divine ideal. I want it to be on the sixth level of meaning. And that initial challenge, to get us to begin to found our lives on the divine ideals. Step one is the redefinition, the reconsecration of the word love to be the real divine ideal that word can symbolize. The personal realization of divine fellowship, a realityizing through the directing act of your will that reconsecrates and solidifies your inner life, predicated on the divine in a way that the world has never seen before. Such a definitive repatterning and re-solidifying of your mind and that personal realization of divine fellowship that, you know, one of the immediate manifestations of that new consecrated state of mind is that you have an immutable desire to do good to others, regardless of who the other is, because you are now defining others transcendent of the difference that has always come to mind when you've thought of others. Well, there's those others that are different to me like that, and those, that level of brotherly love where you're noticing the bottom-up differences. Now, these others, this desire to do good to others, these others are all equal in the eyes of the Universal Father. They're not male nor female nor anything else you can think of. They're absolutely, spiritually unified personalities.
Right.
Yeah. To transcend all temperament selves, right? Even to transcend the character that someone's developed. I mean, you have a character that's kind of consecrated on the fifth level of meaning. Right? But see, to even transcend that, right? Personalities don't have characters. They certainly don't have temperaments. They just are. To start there in your definition of other, that's another personality. So I say, well, what's their character and what's their temperament? No, I'm starting transcendent of that. That's initially irrelevant. They're a person made so by the Universal Father who has no outer life, who knows not issues of character and temperament.
Right. Yeah. You have to remind us of that often here.
That level of, of lifting the word love up so that it literally, see, not just some material-based quote-unquote ideal. No. A divine ideal, a deity likeness ideal, right? An ideal that fundamentally isn't even based on reality. It's based on deity. That kind of an ideal, that kind of love. That's the new commandment.
Oh, but it feels like love just ought to be a feeling. And that's the problem, isn't it? We get stuck in this well.
Yeah, for sure. And to cure yourself of that, you need to do more than just transcend feelings by kindness. You need to transcend kindness.
Yeah.
Because kindness is the brotherly love.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kin-likeness.
Likeness.
Yeah.
The literalness of the word. The old Western expression, we don't like your kind, right? Because we're kind of clan-like and you're not of our clan, you're not our kin.
Mm-hmm.
See? If I transcended that, if I transcended clan and tribe like that, By starting with love, maybe there would be then a place for national life as a fellow divine ideal. See how you can begin to recognize how those experiential divine ideals follow suit? If you start with genuine new commandment love?
Yeah, that's interesting.
Just we could kind of go on and on here like this, but it's just, all these points. Just everyone keep in mind of how lowly we start. Like Brad was kind of discovering and what he was up against, the basically hardwired part of his mind, relative to a long time feline companion.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, Chris, just to back up a tiny bit, so with love, the type of love you're talking about, we would be able to translate that into national life and have the loyalists, the opposing loyalists. What do you call it?
The loyal opposition?
Loyal opposition.
The loyal opposition. It seems like we don't have a lot of that around, and that's
right,
a shame,
right.
And that's,
I mean,
when that happens.
Right. That requires objectivity, right, which you don't find from the bottom up, right?
Yeah.
Right. That's why, you know, people who, you know, who are really defined bottom up, when they use the word objective, what they mean is that's when everyone is identical to me. The object.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. You know, for anybody out there listening, I was listening to Civilization Human Government from July 5th, 2016. And just today, you guys talked about that exact thing, the difference between objectivity and subjectivity. And how,
yeah,
and how we just almost make it, it's a joke the way we think about it. And so at about a minute, an hour and 20 minutes into the show, you'll hear it. It's really well done. And he goes into a lot more detail. Chris does.
Thank you. Yeah, what am I doing? I'm just trying to... I'm trying to deal with the emergency situation. It's like, okay, wow, okay, so we really don't even have a grasp of the difference between subjective and objective anymore. Okay.
Yeah.
You know,
yep.
We're getting into some very tenuous territory here.
Call,
you know,
me.
And we think we're going to be civilized.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, but see, it all begins with real love, followed by the preeminence of the individual and family life, and national life, and representative government. Right, we bring the existential down into the experiential, and all the way down to where the rubber meets the road at the scientific application. And that sort of consecrated individuals could produce an advancing civilization. Divine ideals from top to bottom, inside and out.
Hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you think those people would need the book? Or can the people just have integrity within themselves to know how to get the job done?
Well, see, when you consecrate your life predicated on that full wholehearted encompassment of divine ideals, you will become hungry,
mm-hmm,
philosophically hungry, in a way mankind has never known.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way to satiate that hunger is with something interestingly called the fifth epical revelation to mankind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that gets me back to my original point. I mean, it's here to satiate that hunger and thirst, which, right, is barely existent, but could be existent, right, if people would choose to start with God instead of with man. We could make more progress with that consecration, you know, than Joshua could long ago, right, in the days of Moses. Choose you this day whom you will serve. Okay, that's an important, definitely, I bring that up all the time. That's an important starting point. But, you know, what a mind now could achieve if it so consecrated itself that a mind back then couldn't even remotely achieve because of all the,
yeah,
evolution of mind that the Supreme has wrought?
Hmm.
Right. Yeah.
We could have a civilization, you know, whose fundamental motive is the quest for knowledge and wisdom and all that, the whole new domain that lies beyond that.
Yeah, but there's so many people on this world that aren't even remotely, they're not even in the material comfort era yet, you know?
Yeah. You know, it was a long time on this planet before a lot of remote people ever even heard the word Jesus.
Yeah.
Quite true.
But, you know, you start with those who can hear, and you trust it to the evolutionary process.
All right.
Well,
shall we?
Yeah, let's roll.
Shall we? All right. Thank you all for the conversation, including me being able to, you know, do my usual strange thing. All right. We are in the Rancho.
One little thing I think you probably remember that, you know, you should be reminded that the cat didn't really go anywhere. Right? You were just observing a little part of the Creative Mother Spirit's mind, and she's still present, unchanged.
Oh, that's cool.
I was thinking about that. I didn't have as precise of a language as what you laid out there, but that is a superior theology to my ham-handed attempts as a teenager. The cat went nowhere. There's no more cat. your interpretation is far more nuanced and more truthful. So,
How big is the Creative Mother Spirit's mind? How many animals does it take to highlight each little tiny nugget of her mind? It's going to take a lot of animals.
And there's quite a few out there. And
yep.
she's got a pretty weird part of her mind because there's cats out there. So there it is.
Right.
Well, it's just,
you
can't judge it. The wholeness of her mind by examining one part of it. But if you could synthesize every animal in the local universe, and get a super summative recognition, then you could see the wholeness of her mind.
Yeah. Wow.
I was just trying to develop some Urantia-fueled stand-up comedy bits, Chris, but I appreciate you pulling me back from the brink.
We should read about someone that has droll humor.
There we go. Yes, 12 humans. All right, here we go. We're reading the Urantia Papers, paper 139 tonight. As a really quick reminder, in case you are a new-time listener, from paper 92, section 4, paragraph 9, the Urantia Papers constitute the most recent presentation of truth to the mortals of Urantia. They differ from all previous revelations. They are not the work of a single universe personality, but a composite presentation by many beings. This is paper 139, is titled The 12 Apostles. We're starting in section 6, titled Honest Nathaniel. You find that on page 1558 of the original single-column publication of the papers, known as the Urantia Book. Nathaniel, the sixth and last of the apostles to be chosen by the Master himself, was brought to Jesus by his friend Philip. He had been associated in several business enterprises with Philip, and with him was on the way down to see John the Baptist when they encountered Jesus.
Yeah, we haven't mentioned it yet, but maybe since we're reading this whole block of papers, as we are here in this arc, we've touched upon a number of these stories already, and going, well, why are they repeating that? Well, you can see that they constructed paper 139 to have a pretty high degree of being able to stand on its own.
Yes.
Which is an interesting thing to recognize just in itself, that they made this little mini universe here of the 12 apostles, right? So it's all kind of one turning universe. But when you're reading sequentially, you're going, well, yeah, we know that. We just read that whole story about Philip and Nathaniel. See how they're wanting it to have a degree of wholeness just kind of in and of itself, which is saying something about the truth that this paper is attempting to encompass.
That's a good point, yeah.
But we did learn that, there's these business enterprises with Philip. Right? So that's an interesting little addition that, and we see here at the end of the next paragraph where Nathaniel was headed, that it was the drive that was behind all of these business ventures that they were attempting.
When Nathaniel joined the apostles, he was 25 years old and was the next to the youngest of the group. He was the youngest of a family of seven, was unmarried, and the only support of aged and infirm parents with whom he lived at Cana. His brothers and sister were either married or deceased, and none lived there. Nathanael and Judas Iscariot were the two best educated men among the 12. Nathanael had thought to become a merchant.
Yeah, see that last sentence, you know, combined with, you know, the significant education. So, yeah, this is an individual that was definitely on a path to move up out of the proletariat, as it were, right? You know, which he was,
right.
He was born into this prolific family of seven, right?
Yeah.
He's kind of literally, you know, emphasizing the sort of proletariat roots, and he's wanting to move up into the merchant class. So he's leaning into things, and he's trying and failing at various business enterprises, but you know he's learning, and then along comes Jesus and just blows that whole scheme up.
Never the same again. Yeah. Jesus did not give Nathanael a nickname, but the 12 soon began to speak of him in terms that signified honesty, sincerity. He was without guile, and this was his great virtue. He was both honest and sincere. The weakness of his character was his pride. He was very proud of his family, his city, his reputation, and his nation, all of which is commendable if it is not carried too far. But Nathanael was inclined to go to extremes with his personal prejudices. He was disposed to prejudge individuals in accordance with his personal opinions. He was not slow to ask the question, even before he had met Jesus, "Can any good thing come out of Nazareth?" But Nathanael was not obstinate, even if he was proud. He was quick to reverse himself when he once looked into Jesus' face.
I mean, it's sort of just dangling there, the way I paraphrase that concept all the time. All good things taken to extreme become bad. See, we have go to extremes.
Yeah.
We have good thing. It's sort of just swirling around amongst the words there in that paragraph. that adage. For those who have never read this, I'm going to put out a spoiler. But you've got it sitting here, this, you know, quote unquote without guile. So one of the big things you bring this up frequently when the apostles are talked about Kermit. So if you read the synoptic gospels, right, the first three gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, right. Yeah, nowhere is Nathanael to be found. But you get to, quote-unquote, without guile, you get to, you know, the Gospel of John, right, and you've got Nathanael. And there's this long-standing, you know, 2,000 years of confusion about this. Some people think, well, I think Nathanael is this other person that they mention in the Synoptic Gospels. Who is that? It's someone named Bartholomew.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see here in the final paragraph of this is
Bartholomew
was the name of his dad. it's like saying John Zebedee, Nathanael Bartholomew. His dad's name is Bartholomew, But, you know, literally to this day, I mean, you've got people say, no, absolutely, I don't, you know, Nathanael's just some other person. That's not one of the apostles. Bartholomew is the apostle. I don't know who this Nathanael guy is. The directness of talking about the apostle Nathanael, see, is blowing up, you know, countless journal articles and books and scholarly careers and
life work, yeah.
Daniel's the apostle, and Bartholomew is his dad's name. The answer is so prosaic, you know. It's the people that, like you said, Brad, dedicated their life's work to this. Yeah, okay, so much for that. But when they're, to kind of quote someone in the Bible talking about Nathaniel, okay, you got to go to John. So there's just that one little detail there. Like I said, this whole issue of how quickly you can take things to extremes and they become net negative then. We don't really have a word besides pride to use for something that hasn't gone to that net negative level. So you use it, but then, see here, and they say his pride, he was proud of his family, et cetera, right, all of which is commendable if not carried too far. It's like, well, see, what we really need is a word that's, when you haven't taken it too far, so that the taking it too far word is pride.
Mm-hmm.
But
right.
We don't have that word.
Yeah. No, so we're all proud parents. Yes.
Yeah, or so we say. And it's like, oh, yeah, but see, that, there's a little edge there that might not actualize, but it's like, no, that's not what you really want to say. You don't want to hint that you're going to take that too far. So it's one of the big voids in the language. Because sometimes, you can say, this is my beloved son in whom I am well pleased, instead of, of whom I'm proud.
Yeah.
Okay, but there's a lot of times when you want a word that has the dynamics of the word pride, but none of the negative potential.
Yeah.
Right? And a word needs to be coined.
Okay. Let's hear it.
Okay.
You've done that, haven't you?
I'm just putting it out there.
Okay.
All right. We'll work on that.
I don't have a coinage, at hand. It's going to be something, rather, new territory, not just kind of reworking old things. Because it's such a, these sort of one syllable words, those, a lot of times they hardly even have an etymology when they're a one syllable word.
Yeah.
Right? They're just a sound that came to be used for a certain concept. Right? Way back in Andite days. Yeah. So anyway, just, to point that out. Pride and prejudice here in this paragraph.
Mm-hmm. There may be a way we can do that. Probably go back to the Greek or something. Phronesis is like good judgment, and that's a labored word. But maybe we can do something for pride not taken too far. All right, homework. All right.
Okay.
The one other thought that I had. They don't actually, to my knowledge, say whether Nathaniel would have actually been a decent merchant, but I'm not so sure that someone without guile would have succeeded as being a merchant in those days.
Maybe
it's just as well he became an apostle.
One day world, there will be merchants without guile. Yeah, how sad is it to record that? It's like, well, you're not going to be successful. Yeah, you're not conniving enough.
It is
sad.
Yeah.
In many respects, Nathaniel was the odd genius of the 12. He was the apostolic philosopher and dreamer, but he was a very practical sort of dreamer. He alternated between seasons of profound philosophy and periods of rare and droll humor. When in the proper mood, he was probably the best storyteller among the 12. Jesus greatly enjoyed hearing Nathaniel discourse on things both serious and frivolous. Nathaniel progressively took Jesus and the kingdom more seriously, but never did he take himself seriously.
Well, that's a that's a foundational positive bottom line, is it not, Dan?
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
And, gee, that's where I got droll humor from. Okay. yeah, so just, you know, I mean, again, a lot of this is very straightforward, but you want to be, you know, we all know we've been kind of highlighting, you know, the basic elements of their temperament or their character, and then, you know, what they very much honored in Jesus's character, you know, and kind of, you know, think very holistically about how all these different elements, right, are woven together, you know, into the being named Nathaniel, and I mean that, you know, that's a very fascinating thing to do with these each of these character sketches. Right, is to not just ingest them part wise, but to synthesize them, see, and get a recognition of the wholeness of the individual, and hence a resonance with the truth that flowed through that individual. You know, I was emphasizing up, you know, just at the beginning about how, you know, you have a wholeness, you know, sort of a one turning of this paper in itself, and you know, in each of the individual character sketches is trying to give you a wholeness of that individual. You know, so you know, you can't help but read in an analytic way. You're going, you know, letter to letter, word to word, and analyzing the text, but you know, take some time to lift out of that analytic examination of each of these individuals and try to reflectively acquire the wholeness of that person.
Yeah. I appreciate you saying that it's a challenging thing to do. Do we have a caller?
We do.
All right.
Let me bring our caller in.
Hello, Vaughn Posmo here.
Hey, Vaughn.
Hi, Vaughn.
Hello, Vaughn.
How you doing?
It's a long story.
How about what's your question? We'll boil it down to something more precise.
You had a question. Can you give me the best shot on what that question was as to the word you were looking for?
No, go for it, Vaughn. What you got?
The word? You want the word that I know that you were asking about?
Yeah. Do you have one? Do you have a candidate?
I have a made up word. Cacatrophiation.
All right.
Cacatrophiation.
Again, like Brad was saying, the problem is a lot of these words that we could coin are kind of like multiple syllable complexities. We need something that's really pithy, like the word pride.
We need Dr. Seuss to coin the word for us.
I'm sorry, what did you say? I talked over you.
I was just saying Dr. Seuss might be able to coin it for us. He was pretty good at that kind of stuff.
How about I define the word cacatrophiation
okay.
in Latin? Hey, what are you laughing about, Chris?
It's just a funny word to hear you say.
It means, you know what it means? It means changed for shit.
I think I sensed that in the etymology. Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
I surely do enjoy these Tuesday nights. Thank you very much.
Glad to have you.
You take care, Vaughn.
Glad to have you here, Vaughn.
Nice. Bye,
Vaughn.
Bye.
Speaking of lowbrow humor, or somewhere in that realm, it did make me think this little thing about rare and droll humor of Nathaniel. Maybe his sense of humor did lead to one of the more insightful questions. Nathaniel, how long must I bear with you? And out come the levels of meaning. From his little,
right.
You know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Know what I mean? Say no more.
Yeah.
All All right. Well, Andrea, would you like to take the reading from here? I hope Andrea is still here. Oh, we may have lost Andrea. Did we?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I was just on mute there.
There she is. Want to carry us forward at paragraph 5?
Sure. Let me know if I'm coming in loud and clear. Otherwise, we'll have somebody else do the reading.
You're solid.
Okay, good. The apostles all loved and respected Nathanael, and he got along with them splendidly, excepting Judas Iscariot. Judas did not think Nathanael took his apostleship sufficiently seriously and once had the temerity to go secretly to Jesus and lodge complaint against him. Said Jesus, Judas, watch carefully your steps. Do not overmagnify your office. Who of us is competent to judge his brother? It is not the Father's will that his children should partake only of the serious things of life. Let me repeat, I have come that my brethren in the flesh may have joy, gladness, and life more abundantly. Go then, Judas, and do well that which has been entrusted to you. But leave Nathanael, your brother, to give account of himself to God. And the memory of this, with that of many similar experiences, long lived in the self-deceiving heart of Judas Iscariot.
You know, before you start, Chris, this is just one of many signposts the revelators give us along the way to populate the resentment that Judas harbored. There are a number of others. It's really quite interesting to log them and see at which point he had turns of heart and changes of sentiment that led him ultimately to betray the master and his fellows.
Yeah, I mean, you know, along the lines of what I was just saying about each of these character sketches, you know, you can go beyond this paper, right? And they, like you're saying, Kermit, very great point to bring up, you know, how you can synthesize the whole picture. We've tried to stress that, you know, if you're going to understand why Judas did what he did, you can't make him some sort of one-dimensional caricature.
And demonizing, right.
Yeah, and easily demonizable, dismissible, you know. It's like, no, he's a child of God. He's encircled in the Holy Spirit. He has a personality given to him by the Universal Father. Father loves him absolutely. And then recognize how a series of unfortunate events, as the saying goes, caused a synthesis, an unfortunate synthesis, a false wholeness within him, you know, that made it seem all, you know, perfectly clear to him, you know, no matter what direction he looked. Right? And then he recognized, no, this is a bubble. I've created a bubble that I'm in. You know, and when that bubble bursts, he's so distraught, he hangs himself.
Yeah.
Right? But to, you know, to see the fullness of how, you know, I mean, because we're talking someone who achieved this in the immediate presence of Jesus. You know, he's not some simplistic caricature, you know.
Right.
Black hat guy.
Right. Exactly.
And I mean, we give us so much about Judas, all those details like you're pointing out, Kermit, so that we can see how we can create a bubble of our own.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Even with the adjuster right there in our minds, even with the Spirit of Truth, the Holy Spirit, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, the entire Urantia book before your eyes.
Yeah.
But
yes.
You know, you can create this bubble, and it doesn't happen all at once. It's little details that build up over decades of your life into a very unfortunate false wholeness of mind.
Yes.
False wholeness. So it feels whole, But it's empty.
That sounds like error.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
A wholehearted error, yes. And then the other thing I wanted to see is that, you know, you brought it up there, Kermit, you know, here we see heart, you know, we see the heart of Judas Iscariot. So you know, they're pointing out, see, that's what's happening. You have these little things that are happening, you know, dislikes and whatnot in the lower domain of Judas, but he's spiritualizing them.
Yeah.
Right?
Drag,
and they're synthesizing into a whole, a false wholeness in the upper domain.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And
this whole issue we keep bringing up,
yeah.
of, you know, what are you spiritualizing? See, that's the problem here. It's you know, it's not, you know, we all have dislikes that we can't, you know, change. They're predicated on our DNA, okay? But we can choose to put a, you know, a watch upon the neck of the hourglass, you know, and not allow those things to get spiritualized up there.
I was thinking about that today, Chris, and I was thinking about hatred. And isn't hatred, in a way, a spirit word? Because when you feel hatred, aren't you dragging it up there into the upper domain?
It's not in a way. It is. The valid word hatred is fully opposite to that word love that we were just talking about on the sixth level of meaning. Real hatred, right, is on the sixth level of meaning.
Huh.
Right? But it most likely didn't originate up there in the upper domain. No, it originated in some, unfortunately, ever more spiritualized dislike from the lower domain.
Sure.
Yeah.
And the only way to prevent that from not happening, you know, to some degree, you know, is to spiritually die, to not have an upper domain. Right. So there's always going to be that tendency for you to spiritualize the things in the lower domain that are unfortunate. So you need to know that that is a natural part of the physics of your mind and, you know, and counteract it. You have to say, no, I will not exalt that. I will not begin the eternalization of that dislike.
Set a guard at the neck of my hourglass, dear Lord.
Yes.
Yeah.
Put a watch upon your heart.
Yeah, right. So true. That's what my thought was about today, so I'm glad we talked about this. Okay. Many times when Jesus was away on the mountain with Peter, James, and John, and things were becoming tense and tangled among the apostles, when even Andrew was in doubt about what to say to his disconsolate brethren, Nathanael would relieve the tension by a bit of philosophy or a flash of humor, good humor too.
See that? Notice? Okay, they're not just flippantly using the word good there.
Right.
Just, we don't have to try to, you know, expand it out, you know, but allow yourself to reflect on it. What is good humor?
Yeah, that's the question I asked when I read it.
Right. To think about how there can be a predicate in the upper domain where goodness technically is, right, to the humor that manifests out from the lower domain. You know, to see things like that anew, you know, they're not just, you know, flippant statements like, well, yeah, we use the word good for everything. It's like, no, that's not the way the midwayers are using it. What do they mean by that?
Yeah, we do use it for everything.
Yeah, and think about how, you know, there's other spots in the book when they talk about how, you know, all of these things that start as just, you know, animal origin creature sort of tendencies, right? Those can all be made new.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And they can be reborn by approaching them from the top down.
Exactly. Yeah.
One day music will have its, you know, have its full origins from above instead of below.
Boy, that'll be something.
And it will no longer be glorified bones on hollow logs.
I just hope people can. I hope people can still do stand up though with good humor.
Yeah, I mean, You can do good humor, you know, that doesn't, you know, just, you know, there's much humorous about the imperfect cosmos.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, I heard a comedian not long ago, and there was nothing untoward about his humor. It was really well done, and I would call it good humor. So, yeah.
Right, enlightened humor. See?
Yeah.
Human humor rather than animal humor.
There you go. Okay. Nathaniel's duty was to look after the families of the 12. He was often absent from the apostolic councils, for when he heard that sickness or anything out of the ordinary had happened to one of his charges, he lost no time in getting to that home. The 12 rested securely in the knowledge that their family's welfare was safe in the hands of Nathaniel. That's lovely.
Yeah, just, you know, all of these things we can point out his issues, but okay, when all is said and done, they were all trusting their families to him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So the boy obviously has more than, you know, animal origin temperament. The boy has some character.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Nathaniel most revered Jesus for his tolerance. He never grew weary of contemplating the broad-mindedness and generous sympathy of the Son of Man.
Hmm. Well, that isn't a reactionary thing like all the other apostles we've just been reading about.
Broad-mindedness.
It's like,
yeah, they were.
Yes, yeah. What were you just talking about? Prejudice and... yeah, right.
Bigotry, right. Intolerance.
Almost always, that's the... Yeah, that's where they start with Jesus. It's like, you know, is how Jesus is the reciprocal of each of them. Yeah, and see, and think about that. There's 12 apostles, and embodied within Jesus is the positive reciprocal of everything in the 12.
Right. Yes.
Just how holistic a character had formed around that faith nucleus in Jesus.
Yeah.
See that last part again about the, what did you just say about,
you know,
the...
You can shine the light of each of the temperaments of the 12 apostles upon Jesus, and you get a reciprocal reflection back.
Okay. Okay,
see,
yeah, that's cool.
Each of the transformed apostle is in Jesus already.
Wow.
Because he embodies the universal harmony of the cosmos, which embodies the positive reciprocal of every being in the universe of universes.
Wow, that's a crazy thought.
Yeah. Think about, see, challenging yourself to embody that kind of a wholeness of character. Right, that there's a point of engagement within you with any other individual.
Hmm.
Right, yeah. Each of us has an absolutely unique relationship to the Universal Father. Where, you know, in that line of engagement, it is only a reciprocal resonance with us, and no one else. But everyone else, right, has their, you know, individual line of reflection.
Sure.
Yes.
He who has seen me has seen the Father. Just, you know, see that, how Jesus embodies that, you know, that each of them can see them, their better self in him.
Wow.
That's
so cool. Okay. Nathaniel's father, Bartholomew, died shortly after Pentecost, after which this apostle went into Mesopotamia and India proclaiming the glad tidings of the kingdom and baptizing believers. His brethren never knew what became of their one-time philosopher, poet, and humorist. But he was also a great man in the kingdom and did much to spread his master's teachings, even though he did not participate in the organization of the subsequent Christian church. Nathaniel died in India. They don't say how old he was.
And just saying Nathaniel died in India, it's like, so maybe the mythology that he was skinned alive and beheaded is not what happened. That sounds rather straightforward.
That's the deal.
Died in India.
It does. It doesn't sound violent at all.
Yeah. It doesn't say Nathaniel was martyred in India. Gruesomely martyred in India.
Is that what the Bible says about how he died?
No. You've got all of the, there's all of these martyrdom speculations, that we've touched upon, with each of these. Stories get told.
Sure.
Well, there's a whole cult of Nathaniel in India anyway.
Oh, really?
I wonder if that's part of it. Yeah.
Sure.
Well, of course, a lot of these stories, I'm saying, they're technically stories about Bartholomew, right? is the way these legends, they're not legends about Nathaniel, they're legends about Bartholomew. There's this whole complicated thing. You have the whole notion of the mission of Bartholomew to India.
Yeah.
But to try to penetrate through, Eusebius and Jerome talking about such things in the Revelation, going, so there's some validity to that. But then there's all kinds of stories and whatnot that you have to, sift out.
Yeah, they're not helping us here much.
No, they usually see are very scant on some of those things. But like I was saying, it's like, Nathaniel died in India. Okay, that is such a simple, basic, straightforward statement. That's making me think that between the lines, the midwayers are giving me a hint that there's a lot of ridiculous elaboration on Nathaniel's death.
Yeah.
All right, number 7, Matthew Levi. Matthew, the seventh apostle, was chosen by Andrew. Matthew belonged to a family of tax gatherers or publicans, but was himself a customs collector in Capernaum, where he lived. He was 31 years old and married and had 4 children. He was a man of moderate wealth, the only one of any means belonging to the apostolic corps. He was a good businessman, a good social mixer, and was gifted with the ability to make friends and to get along smoothly with a great variety of people.
This is another confusing thing. Is his name Matthew? Is his name Levi? And again, all of the, years, centuries of confusion about all this. Not to belabor that point again, every one of these apostles has all kinds of historical confusion about things. Even in the Revelation, it's like, it seems like there are alternative, names for the individual. But then at other times it's like, wait a minute, but you almost seem to be using it like a last name sometimes. We don't, technically have first name, last name back then. And interestingly, the Revelators don't, definitively clear that up. So they kind of leave us dangling, But the fact that they, the title is Matthew Levi, to just say it like that, it's like, it's not that his dad's name is Levi. it seems like maybe, you know, you kind of have just two different ways of referring to him. You know, and both embodied in the literalness of those, you know, of those Hebrew names. Yeah, we don't need to go off on all that tangent, but just yeah, you can definitely see that you know, a lot of times they're just alternative, just names for the individual, but then occasionally it's like, well, now they're kind of talking about the Levi family, not Levi's family,
yeah.
Right? So it's like, so there's just a little bit of mystery that's, you know, kind of remains there on that one.
All right. Andrew appointed Matthew the financial representative of the apostles. In a way, he was the fiscal agent and publicity spokesperson for the apostolic organization. He was a keen judge of human nature and a very efficient propagandist. His is a personality difficult to visualize, but he was a very earnest disciple and an increasing believer in the mission of Jesus and in the certainty of the kingdom. Jesus never gave Levi a nickname, but his fellow apostles commonly referred to him as the money getter.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. That just
yeah.
seemed.
It's almost like we were talking before. That very, very literal, straightforward here. not imaginative nicknames here. But you know, notice that
propagandist.
You know, okay, so Matthew's not a nickname, right? For Levi, right? So. You know, one of those scholarly speculations for those who think that those are referring to the same individual instead of two different individuals, right? It's kind of, it's like, well, no, it's saying right there it wasn't sort of an apostolic nickname. You know, Matthew.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
You know.
So was Levi kind of like his middle name then?
I guess you just don't have first name, middle name, last name stuff. You know, it's just, so... Yeah, you know, you're left. It's in some way is just alternative names. You know, we'll see that when we get to the Alpheus twins too.
Okay. Levi's strong
notice the word
point.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Yeah, just an efficient propagandist. That didn't
yeah.
that great on anybody.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up.
Rub anybody.
yeah, and just. Yeah, but, you know, it's all of the negative baggage that that word has taken on. You know, I mean,
yep.
you abuse propaganda and it gives propaganda a bad name.
Yeah,
right.
We think about propaganda
yes.
as promoting falsehood, but
it's like
yes.
when you
have
abuse,
to be.
Yes.
Yeah. If you abuse discrimination, you give discrimination a bad name.
Right. Yeah,
so we've exactly. got these issues in
okay.
the language.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Levi's strong point was his wholehearted devotion to the cause, that he, a publican, had been taken in by Jesus and his apostles was the cause for overwhelming gratitude on the part of the former revenue collector. However, it required some little time for the rest of the apostles, especially Simon Zelotes and Judas Iscariot, to become reconciled to the publican's presence in their midst. Matthew's weakness was his short-sighted and materialistic viewpoint of life, but in all these matters, he made great progress as the months went by. He, of course, had to be absent from many of the most precious seasons of instructions, as it was his duty to keep the treasury replenished. Huh, you wonder what he was out doing.
Getting money.
Yeah.
I know, but in what was his method? Was he going door to door or?
Well, no, they describe that basically. You know, he has a number of select individuals who have deep pockets and okay. You know, and who have an affinity to the to Jesus's ministry.
I see.
Yeah.
Yep. So okay. He makes the rounds. And
kind of like, hey, can I take you out to lunch today? Let's talk some money. All right, Kermit, would you like to take over the reading if we're done chatting?
Sure,
that'd
be great. Sure. Thank you. It was the Master's forgiving disposition which Matthew most appreciated. He would never cease to recount that faith only was necessary in the business of finding God. He always liked to speak of the kingdom as this business of finding God.
Wow, that's neat.
Yeah, and again, you know, just simple things like, you know, appreciating the wholeness of the individual so that, you know, he summarizes in sort of his own metaphoric or, you know, way, you know, how to speak of it, this business, right, of finding God. You know, and the whole, you know, just universal, you know, negative feelings that everyone had about publicans. Right. I mean, so what is he going to, you know, admire in the Master? A forgiving disposition.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
It's always going to start. Is that, you know, that reflection of, you know, of how Jesus fills an emptiness within that individual.
Yeah. Though Matthew was a man with a past, he gave an excellent account of himself, and as time went on, his associates became proud of the publican's performances. He was one of the apostles who made extensive notes on the sayings of Jesus, and these notes were used as the basis of Isidore's subsequent narrative of the sayings and doings of Jesus, which has become known as the Gospel according to Matthew.
Again, we see how they're
proud,
giving us little snippets of, you know, what they give up at the, you know, towards the beginning of part four, you know, about the Gospels, but to,
yeah,
to have it kind of be, you know, a fairly self-contained package here in paper 139.
Look at the use.
You're
going to
say something,
Brad?
Right?
It doesn't seem.
Oh no, just thinking this. In fairness, you know, this character sketch is a little bit off from the way The Chosen characterized Matthew as a, you know, barely social viable autistic person.
Wow.
It's a, you know, very, very good with numbers, but not good with people. It's like, no, this was a money getter. This was a guy like, hey, have you heard about the Gospel of Jesus? Yeah.
Yeah.
Smooth operator.
Yeah.
I think you were going to comment there, Kermit. Yeah. We see the word proud again.
Doesn't seem to be used in too hard a manner. Seems
no.
Lightly applied.
Right.
Yeah, we sort of have to just, you know, let the word pride and proud, you know, serve this, you know, this positive purpose, in sentences. But like I said, I mean, deep down there's a tension. It's like there needs to be a better word. Something that you can still feel as definitively as the word pride, but doesn't have that, you know, unfortunate potential embodied in it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. The great and useful life of Matthew, the businessman and customs collector of Capernaum, has been the means of leading thousands upon thousands of other businessmen, public officials, and politicians down through the subsequent ages, also to hear that engaging voice of the Master saying, "Follow me." Matthew really was a shrewd politician, but he was intensely loyal to Jesus and supremely devoted to the task of seeing that the messengers of the coming kingdom were adequately financed.
Yeah, notice how the big conversation we had before we started reading, you know, how we were touching upon issues like this. I mean, think, oh man, if only we had Matthew today to, you know, reach the businessmen, public officials, and politicians of our day. Like, well, okay, it's a positive thought. I don't want to be pessimistic here. However,
sooner or later, a greater Matthew will come.
Yeah, and we're in ever need of a greater Matthew. Because, boy, oh boy, right? It's we can immediately think of a lot of these these public figures that don't seem to have an emptiness that is looking for Matthew to fill the void. They're quite self-satisfied and cosmically empty inside. And it's just, it becomes, it's just like, if only we had politicians who all had a God nucleus, right, instead of a man nucleus or a self nucleus.
I saw one today on TV that certainly seemed to have a God nucleus, the state representative, I can't remember his position, from the state of Arizona. He was amazing today. He very much articulated his relationship with God was the reason for his performance. It was very inspiring.
Well, and it's just, we want to make sure that, not to belabor this, but to think about this in fifth epical terms, right? I mean, the reason there's an emergency is not because there's selfish politicians, right? The problem is that more and more it's this secular totalitarianism, right? I mean, that's the title of the section, not self-based totalitarianism, right? It isn't purely a selfish issue. Anyone with power, we all know that's a problem if they're very self-centered. Appreciate what the revelation is here to awaken us to the fact that there's a bigger issue in play than selfishness and self-motivation. And there's this very insidious thing where there's fewer and fewer politicians or bureaucrats or whatnot that that would be inspired by Matthew's message.
The presence of Matthew among the 12 was the means of keeping the doors of the kingdom wide open to hosts of downhearted and outcast souls who had regarded themselves as long since without the bounds of religious consolation. Outcast and despairing men and women flocked to hear Jesus, and he never turned one away.
See, just quickly to emphasize, you've got these individuals that Matthew's engaging who have long thought themselves to be, without the bounds of religious consolation. See, they're hungry. They're just waiting for, a minister that can speak to them. When you have a genuine secularist, they're never thinking, well, boy, I'm without the bounds of religious consolation. No. They would never speak to themselves that way. They would never feel attention that way. Right? They're totally satisfied apart from God.
Yeah.
These people wish that there was a way that they could be closer to God, but the theology of the day has told them, it's like, no, you're out of luck. There's no way for you to approach God. And Matthew could say, no, that's not true. And I exist as proof of that. Right? He could reach them. He could give them that religious consolation that God loves them. Because they want to be loved by God, but they think there's no way that God can love them. But what if you have people that don't care about God? I believe that that's just a bunch of garbage.
Yeah.
What kind of a tax collector do you get then?
Hmm.
Matthew received freely tendered offerings from believing disciples and the immediate auditors of the Master's teachings, but he never openly solicited funds from the multitudes. He did all his financial work in a quiet and personal way and raised most of the money among the more substantial class of interested believers. He gave practically the whole of his modest fortune to the work of the Master and his apostles, but they never knew of this generosity save Jesus, who knew all about it. Matthew hesitated openly to contribute to the apostolic funds for fear that Jesus and his associates might regard his money as being tainted. So he gave much in the names of other believers. During the earlier months, when Matthew knew his presence among them was more or less of a trial, he was strongly tempted to let them know that his funds often supplied them with their daily bread. But he did not yield. When evidence of the disdain of the publican would become manifest, Levi would burn to reveal to them his generosity, but always he managed to keep still.
That sounds like a strength of character issue there. I'm always impressed when I read that paragraph. Who among us could do
yes.
that?
Yeah.
Yeah, really.
I agree.
See, and notice there, they seem to be using Levi as sort of the name for his lower domain and Matthew is the name for his upper domain.
Oh,
interesting.
Wow.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Jekyll and Hyde, huh?
Yeah, so that's one seemingly maybe a little hint. Like you were saying, I mean, you know, to notice when they aren't just talking about temperament, but when they're talking about a character that can stand unmoved even in the face of, you know, vigorous assault.
Yeah.
When the funds for the week were short of the estimated requirements, Levi would often draw heavily upon his own personal resources. Also, sometimes when he became greatly interested in Jesus' teaching, he preferred to remain and hear the instruction, even though he knew he must personally make up for his failure to solicit the necessary funds. But Levi did so wish that Jesus might know that much of the money came from his pocket. He little realized that the Master knew all about it. The apostles all died without knowing that Matthew was their benefactor to such an extent that when he went forth to proclaim the gospel of the kingdom after the beginning of the persecutions, he was practically penniless.
Yeah, so, you know, just see how much he had to just abide with. And he obviously had the strength of character to just, you know, let that be. But Levi did so wish, see, not Matthew. I mean, it's a little bit suspicious. I don't know if it's that valid, but it kind of, yeah, the very fact that Levi is so much more of a, you know, an ancient, you know, Hebrew name. Yeah, the whole quote-unquote 12 tribes thing, right?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, there may be something on that order. You know, so it's not Levi's gospel. Yeah, it is Matthew's gospel.
When these persecutions caused the believers to forsake Jerusalem, Matthew journeyed north, preaching the gospel of the kingdom and baptizing believers. He was lost to the knowledge of his former apostolic associates, but on he went, preaching and baptizing through Syria, Cappadocia, Galatia, Bithynia, and Thrace. And it was in Thrace, at Lysimachia, that certain unbelieving Jews conspired with the Roman soldiers to encompass his death. And this regenerated publican died triumphant in the faith of a salvation he had so surely learned from the teachings of the Master during his recent sojourn on earth.
See, so, you know, no wonder, you know, history kind of lost track of where he went. You know, he's going north and arching, you know, to the west, you know, more along, you know, kind of along the northern parts of Asia Minor there, see, than the southern parts, you know, more on the Black Sea side of Asia Minor than the Mediterranean side, you know, and ending up over there in Thrace. So, you know, there's, you know, and there's, you know, if you look into what's speculated and what's seemingly recorded by some, you know, you can see, oh, they had a little bit of a hint of what the Midwayers are laying out definitively, you know, including having these unbelieving Jews conspiring with the Roman soldiers. It's like, huh, so maybe some of that, you know, Jewish record is actually talking about Matthew and not just some other person named Matthew.
Yeah.
I'll just kind of toss that out without getting into the details. But you can, you know, if you do a little exploring, you'll see that there might be little hints that that the Midwayers are dropping here and there.
You know, I'm wondering what was the life, I mean, what was it like when Matthew a practicing Jew that was, I mean, I get the sense that publicans might not have been welcome at the temple. How would that have worked?
Yeah, well, yeah, I don't know exactly how that all hung together. But, you know, I mean, he's very much, you know, interested in, you know, putting Jesus into that Jewish context.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Read the Gospel
right.
of Matthew.
exactly. Right. Yeah, exactly.
Starts
so,
with a bang, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, he's, and, you know, and seeing that kind of feeds in, you know, him being treated as a very apostate individual by other Jews.
Okay,
you know, just
sure.
the very fact that he puts such emphasis, right, on the Jewishness of Jesus. You can kind of feel the tension between the lines there of these little, like I said, these little hints that they give you. You know, and we kind of are running out of time. We thought we might get into Thomas tonight here, but we should probably just, you know, start that up fresh next time and talk out some of these details in the remaining couple minutes here.
Yeah.
Right. Some other thoughts you guys had on some of these little tidbits they were tossing at us here towards the end?
Well, I've always been drawn to this thing about him secretly funding the treasury. I guess my work in some nonprofit organizations, you know, discreet benefactors. Yeah, I've already kind of said that, but I think that it helps inform, it colors my reading of the rest of part four. Every time I read it, like you were saying earlier, Chris, in that more holistic sense, just keep this sketch of Matthew in your mind and get a sense of, like, how is that informing how he's interacting with Jesus in this moment? He's around listening to Jesus' teachings. Is he paying for that out of his own pocket because he's not able to leave and raise money? It raises my esteem for him, not my self-esteem, my esteem for Matthew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then, you know, it's so obvious the Midwayers are trying to help you understand, you know, what the limitations are of, you know, what Matthew says or, you know, or what Peter says or whatever, you know, I mean, various things that are in the New Testament, right, they're all, you know, colored by their temperaments, by whether or not they were present or not at times, and all these sorts of things, right?
Yeah.
You know, there's all of this historical detail and context for interpreting exactly the differences of the stories told in the New Testament from the different perspectives.
What a gift paper 139 is to us. It helps us recontextualize the New Testament, and it contextualizes the entire rest of the Urantia Papers, just like every paper in the Urantia Papers gives context to all the others. It's one synthetic whole. Join us again next week. We will continue on with Thomas Didymus. Until then, follow the way.
God bless all.
Good night, everyone.
Yep. Everyone take care. Everyone have a great week. And yeah, join us back again next week. We'll pick up on the redundancy of the title of Section 8. Bye now.